It is August 14th, 1965. A little over 2 years since the day the sun went out. It is Will's birthday. He has gone around all day solemnly telling people that he has now lived a year for each inning in a baseball game. Jessie is unable to understand why this seems like a big deal to her brother, but it clearly does, and she decides that if Will wants to compare his life to a baseball game, that's perfectly okay. For quite a while, everything that happens at her little brother's birthday party is perfectly okay. Marvin Gaye is on the record player, true, but it is not the bad song, the dangerous song. "I wouldn't be doggone," Marvin sings, mock-threatening. "I be long gone, baby." Actually sort of a cute song, and the truth is that the day has been a lot better than okay, at least so far. It has been, in the words of Jessie's great-aunt Catherine, finer than fiddle music. Even her dad thinks so, although he wasn't very keen on the idea of coming back to Falmouth for Will's birthday when the idea was first suggested. Jessie had heard him say, "I guess it was a pretty good idea after all," to her mom, and that makes her feel good, because it was she, Jessie Mayhoot, daughter of Tom and Sally, sister of Will and Maddie, wife of nobody, who put the idea over. She's the reason they're here instead of inland at Sunset Trails. Sunset Trails is the family camp, although after 3 generations of haphazard family expansion, it is really big enough to be called a compound, on the north end of Darkscore Lake. This year they have broken their customary 9 weeks of seclusion there, because Will wants, just once, he has told his mother and father, speaking in the tones of a nobly suffering old grandee who knows he cannot cheat the reaper much longer, to have a birthday party with his rest-of-the-year friends as well as his family. Tom Mayhoot vetoes the idea at first. He is a stockbroker who divides his time between Portland and Boston, and for years he's told his family not to believe all that propaganda about how guys who go to work wearing ties and shirts with white collars spend their days goofing off, either hanging around the water cooler or dictating lunch invitations to pretty blondes from the Steno pool. "No hard-scrapple spud farmer in Aroostook County works any harder than I do," he frequently tells them. "Keeping up with the market isn't easy, and it isn't particularly glamorous either, no matter what you may have heard to the contrary." The truth is, none of them have heard anything to the contrary. All of them, his wife included, most likely, although Sally would never say so, think his job sounds duller than donkey shit, and only Maddie has the vaguest idea of what it is he does. Tom insists that he needs that time on the lake to recover from the stresses of his job, and that his son will have plenty of birthdays with his friends later on. Will is turning 9, after all, not 90. "Plus," Tom adds, "birthday parties with your pals really aren't much fun until you're old enough to have a keg or two." So Will's request to have his birthday at the family's year-round home on the coast would probably have been denied if not for Jessie's sudden, surprising support of the plan. And to Will it's plenty surprising. Jessie is 3 years older, and lots of times he's not sure she remembers she even has a brother. Following her initial soft-voiced suggestion that maybe it would be fun to come home, just for 2 or 3 days, of course, and have a lawn party with croquet and badminton and a barbecue and Japanese lanterns that would come on at dusk, Tom begins to warm to the idea. He is the sort of man who thinks of himself as a strong-willed son of a bitch, and is often thought of as a stubborn old goat by others. Whichever way you saw it, he has always been a tough man to move once he has set his feet and his jaw. His younger daughter is an exception to the general rule. Jessie has often found a way into her father's mind by some loophole or secret passage denied to the rest of the family. Sally believes it's just that their middle child is Tom's favorite, and Tom has fooled himself into believing that none of the others know. Maddie and Will see it in simpler terms. They believe that Jessie sucks up to their father, and that he in turn spoils her rotten. "If Daddy caught Jessie smoking," Will told his older sister the year before, after Maddie had been grounded for that very offense, "he'd probably buy her a lighter." Maddie laughed, agreed, and hugged her brother. Neither they nor her mother would have the slightest idea of the secret which lies between Tom Mayhoot and his younger daughter, like a heap of rotting meat. Jessie herself believes she is just going along with her baby brother's request, that she's sticking up for him, She has no idea, not on the surface of her mind anyway, how much she has come to hate Sunset Trails and how eager she is to get away. She has also come to hate the lake she once passionately loved, especially its faint, flat, mineral smell. By 1965, she can hardly bear to go swimming there, even on the hottest of days. She knows her mother thinks it's her shape. Jessie began to bud early, as Sally did herself, and at the age of 12, she has most of her woman's figure. But it's not her shape. She's gotten used to that, and knows that she's a long way from being a playboy pinup in either of her old, faded Janssen tank suits. No, it's not her breasts, not her hips, not her can. It's that smell. Whatever reasons and motives may be swirling around beneath, Will Mayhoot's request is finally approved by the Mayhoot family's head honcho. They made the trip back to the coast yesterday, leaving early enough for Sally, eagerly assisted by both daughters, to prepare for the party. And now it's August 14th, and August 14th is surely the apotheosis of summer in Maine, a day of faded blue denim skies and fat white clouds, all of it freshened by a salt-tangy breeze. Inland, and that includes the Lakes District, where Sunset Trails has stood on the shore of Darkscore Lake since Tom Mayhoot's grandfather built the original cabin in 1923. The woods and lakes and ponds and bogs lie sweltering under temperatures in the mid-90s, and humidity just below the saturation point. But here on the seacoast, it's only 80. The sea breeze is an extra bonus, rendering the humidity negligible and sweeping away the mosquitoes and the sandflies. The lawn is filled with children, mostly Will's friends, but girls who chum with Maddie and Jessie as well. And for once, mirabile dictu, they all seem to be getting along. There hasn't been a single argument, and around 5 o'clock, as Tom raises the first martini of the day to his lips, he glances at Jessie, who is standing nearby with her croquet mallet propped on her shoulder like a sentry's rifle, and who is clearly within earshot of what sounds like a casual husband and wife conversation, but which may actually be a shrewd bank-shot compliment aimed at his daughter, then back at his wife. "I guess it was actually a pretty good idea, after all," he says. "Better than good," Jessie thinks. "Absolutely great and totally monster, if you want to know the truth." Even that isn't what she really means, really thinks. But it would be dangerous to say the rest out loud. It would tempt the gods. What she really thinks is that the day is flawless, a sweet and perfect peach of a day. Even the song blasting out of Maddie's portable record player, which Jessie's big sister has cheerfully carted out to the patio for this occasion, although it is ordinarily the great untouchable icon, is okay. Jessie is never really going to like Marvin Gaye, no more than she is ever going to like that faint mineral smell which rises from the lake on hot summer afternoons. But this song is okay. "I'll be doggone if you ain't a pretty thing, baby." Silly, but not dangerous. It is August 14th, 1965, a day that was, a day that still is, in the mind of a dreaming woman handcuffed to a bed, in a house on the shore of a lake 40 miles south of Darkscore, but with the same mineral smell, that nasty evocative smell, on hot, still summer days. And although the 12-year-old girl she was doesn't see Will creeping up behind her as she bends over to address her croquet ball, turning her bottom into a target simply too tempting for a boy who has only lived 1 year for each inning in a baseball game to ignore, part of her mind knows he is there, and that this is the seam where the dream has been basted to the nightmare. She lines up her shot, concentrating on the wicket 6 feet away. A hard shot, but not an impossible one. And if she drives the ball through, she may well catch Carolyn after all. That would be nice, because Carolyn almost always wins at croquet. Then just as she draws her mallet back, the music coming from the record player changes. "Oh, listen, everybody," Marvin Gaye sings, sounding a lot more than just mock-threatening to Jessie this time. "Especially you girls." Chills of goose flesh run up Jessie's tanned arms. Is it right to be left alone when the one you love is never home? I love too hard, my friends sometimes say. Her fingers go numb, and she loses any sense of the mallet in her hands. Her wrists are tingling, as if bound by... Stocks. Goody's in the stocks. Come and see Goody in the stocks. Come and laugh at Goody in the stocks. Unseen clamps, and her heart is suddenly full of dismay. It is the other song, the wrong song, the bad song. But I believe, that a woman should be loved this way. She looks up at the little group of girls waiting for her to make her shot, and sees that Carolyn is gone. Standing there in her place is Nora Callaghan. Her hair is in braids. There's a dab of white zinc on the tip of her nose. She's wearing Carolyn's yellow sneakers and Carolyn's locket, the one with a tiny picture of Paul McCartney inside it. But those are Nora's green eyes, and they are looking at her with a deep, adult compassion. Jesse suddenly remembers that Will, undoubtedly egged on by his buddies, who are as jazzed up on Cokes and German chocolate cake as Will himself, is creeping up behind her, that he's preparing to goose her. She will overreact wildly when he does, swinging around and punching him in the mouth, perhaps not spoiling the party completely, but certainly putting a ding in its sweet perfection. She tries to let go of the mallet, wanting to straighten and turn around before any of this can happen. She wants to change the past, but the past is heavy. Trying to do that, she discovers, is like trying to pick up the house by one corner so you can look under it for things that have been lost, or forgotten, or hidden. Behind her, someone has cranked the volume on Maddie's little record player, and that terrible song blares louder than ever, triumphant and glittery and sadistic. It hurts me so inside, to be treated so unkind. Somebody, somewhere, tell her it ain't fair. She tries again to get rid of the mallet, to throw it away, but she can't do it. It's as if someone has handcuffed her to it. Nora, she cries. Nora, you have to help me. Stop him. It was at this point in the dream that Jesse moaned for the first time, momentarily startling the dog back from Gerald's body. Nora shakes her head slowly and gravely. I can't help you, Jesse. You're on your own. We all are. I generally don't tell my patients that, but I think in your case it's best to be honest. You don't understand. I can't go through this again. I can't. Oh, don't be so silly, Nora says, suddenly impatient. She begins to turn away, as if she can no longer bear the sight of Jesse's upturned, frantic face. You will not die. It's not poison. Jesse looks around wildly, although she remains unable to straighten up, to stop presenting that tempting target to her impending brother, and sees that her friend Tammy Ho is gone. Standing there in Tammy's white shorts and yellow halter is Ruth Neary. She's holding Tammy's red-striped croquet mallet in one hand and a Marlboro in the other. Her mouth is hooked up at the corners in her usual sardonic grin, but her eyes are grave and full of sorrow. Ruth, help me! Jesse shouts. You have to help me! Ruth takes a big drag on her cigarette and grinds it into the grass with one of Tammy Ho's cork-soled sandals. Jeepers, creepers, Tootsie. He's going to goose you, not stick a cattle prod up your ass. You know that as well as I do. You've been through all this before. So what's the big deal? It isn't just a goose. It isn't, and you know it. The old hooty-owl hooty-hoos to the goose, Ruth says. What? What does that mean? It means how can I know anything about anything? Ruth shoots back. There is anger on the surface of her voice, deep hurt beneath. You wouldn't tell me. You wouldn't tell anybody. You ran away. You ran like a rabbit that sees the shadow of some old hooty owl on the grass. I couldn't tell! Jessie shrieks. Now she can see a shadow on the grass beside her. as if Ruth's words have conjured it up. It is not the shadow of an owl, however. It is the shadow of her brother. She can hear the stifled giggles of his friends, knows he is reaching out to do it, and still she cannot even straighten up, let alone move away. She is helpless to change what is going to happen, and she understands that this is the very essence of both nightmare and tragedy. Not fear, but helplessness. I couldn't! She shrieks at Ruth again. I couldn't, not ever! It would have killed my mom or destroyed the family or both! He said! Daddy said! I hate to be the one to send you this particular news flash, Tootsie Wootsie, but your dear old dad will have been dead 12 years come December. Also, can't we dispense with at least a little of this melodrama? It's not as if he hung you from the clothesline by the nipples and then set your twat on fire, you know. But she doesn't want to hear this. Doesn't want to consider, even in a dream, any reappraisal of her buried past. Once the dominoes start to fall, who knows where it will all end? So she blocks her ears to what Ruth is saying and continues to fix her old college roommate with that deep, pleading stare that so often caused Ruth, whose tough cookie veneer was never more than frosting deep anyway, to laugh and give in, to do whatever it was Jesse wanted her to do. Ruth, you have to help me. You have to. But this time the pleading stare doesn't work. I don't think so, Toots. The sorority Susies are all gone. The time for shutting up is over. Running away is out of the question. And waking up is not an option. This is the mystery train, Jesse. You're the pussycat, I'm the owl. Here we go. All aboard. Fasten your seatbelt and fasten it tight. This is an e-ticket ride. No! But now, to Jesse's horror, the day begins to darken. It could just be the sun going behind a cloud, but she knows it isn't. The sun is going out. Soon the stars will shine in a summer afternoon sky, and the old hooty owl will hooty-hoo to the dove. The time of the eclipse has come. No! She screams again. That was 2 years ago! You're wrong on that one, Toots, Ruth Neary says. For you, it never ended. For you, the sun never came back out. She opens her mouth to deny that, to tell Ruth she's as guilty of wild overdramatization as Nora, who kept shoving her toward doors she didn't want to open, who kept assuring her that the present can be improved by examining the past, as if one could improve the taste of today's dinner by slathering it with the maggoty remains of yesterday's. She wants to tell Ruth, as she told Nora on the day she walked out of Nora's office for good, that there is a big difference between living with something and being kept prisoner by it. Don't you two goofs understand that the cult of the self is just another cult? She wants to say. But before she can do more than open her mouth, the invasion comes. A hand between her slightly spread legs, the thumb shoving rudely at the cleft of her buttocks, the fingers pressed against the material of her shorts just above her vagina. And it is not her brother's innocent little hand this time. The hand between her legs is much bigger than Will's and not a bit innocent. The bad song is on the radio. The stars are out at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And this, you will not die, it's not poison, is how big people goose each other. She whirls, expecting to see her father. He did something like this to her during the eclipse, a thing she supposes the whining cult of selfers that live in the pastures like Ruth and Nora would call child abuse. Whatever it was, it will be him, she's sure of that much, and she is afraid she will exact a terrible punishment for the thing he did, no matter how serious or trivial that thing was. She will raise the croquet mallet and drive it into his face, smashing his nose and knocking out his teeth. And when he falls down on the grass, the dogs will come and eat him up. Except it isn't Tom Mayhoot standing there, It's Gerald. He's naked. The penis of an attorney pokes out at her from below the soft pink bowl of his belly. He has a set of Krieg police handcuffs in each hand. He holds them out to her in the weird afternoon darkness. Unnatural starlight gleams on the cocked jaws, which are stamped M17, because his source could not provide him with any F-23s. "Come on, Jess," he says, grinning. "It isn't as though you don't know the score. Besides, you liked it. That first time you came so hard you almost blew up. I don't mind telling you that was the best piece of ass I ever had in my life. So good I sometimes dream about it. And you know why it was so good? Because you didn't have to take any of the responsibility. Almost all women like it better when the man takes over completely. It's a proven fact of female psychology. Did you come when your father molested you, Jesse? I bet you did. I bet you came so hard you almost blew up. The cult of the selfers may want to argue about these things, but we know the truth, don't we? Some women can say they want it, but some need a man to tell them they want it. You're one of the latter. But that's okay, Jesse. That's what the cuffs are for. Only they were never really handcuffs at all. They're bracelets of love. So put them on, sweetheart. Put them on." She backs up, shaking her head, not knowing if she wants to laugh or cry. The subject itself is new, but the rhetoric is all too familiar. "The lawyer's tricks don't work on me, Gerald. I've been married to one too long. What we both know is that the business with the handcuffs was never about me at all. It was about you. About waking up your old booze-stunned John Thomas a little, to be blunt. So you can just save your fucked-up version of female psychology, okay?" Gerald is smiling in a knowing, disconcerted way. "Good try, babe. It doesn't wash, but it was still a damn good shot. The best defense is a good offense, right? I think I taught you that. Never mind, though. Right now, you've got a choice to make. Either put the bracelets on or swing that mallet and kill me again." She looks around and realizes with dawning panic and dismay that everyone at Will's party is watching her confrontation with this naked, except for his glasses, that is, overweight, sexually aroused man. And it's not just her family and her childhood friends, either. Mrs. Henderson, who will be her freshman advisor at college, is standing by the punch bowl. Bobby Hagen, who will take her to the senior prom and fuck her afterwards in the back seat of his father's Oldsmobile 88, is standing on the patio next to the blonde girl from the Newworth Parsonage, the one whose parents had loved her but idolized her brother. Barry, Jesse thinks. She's Olivia, and her brother's Barry. The blonde girl is listening to Bobby Hagen but looking at Jesse, her face calm but somehow haggard. She is wearing a sweatshirt which shows R. Crumb's Mr. Natural hurrying down a city street. The words in the balloon coming out of Mr. Natural's mouth say, "Vice is nice, but incest is best." Behind Olivia, Kendall Wilson, who will hire Jesse for her first teaching job, is cutting a piece of chocolate birthday cake for Mrs. Page, her childhood piano teacher. Mrs. Page is looking remarkably lively for a woman who died of a stroke 2 years ago while picking apples at Corritz Orchards in Alfred. Jesse thinks, "This isn't like dreaming. It's like drowning. Everyone I've ever known seems to be standing here under this weird starlit afternoon sky, watching my naked husband try to put me in handcuffs, while Marvin Gaye sings, 'Can I Get a Witness?' If there's any comfort to be had, it's this. Things can't possibly get any worse." Then they do. Mrs. Wirtz, her first grade teacher, starts to laugh. Old Mr. Cobb, their gardener until he retired in 1964, laughs with her. Maddie joins in, and Ruth, and Olivia of the scarred breasts. Kendall Wilson and Bobby Hagen are bent almost double, and they're clapping each other on the back like men who have heard the granddaddy of all dirty jokes in the local barber shop. Perhaps the one whose punchline is, "A life support system for a cunt." Jessie looks down at herself and sees that now she is naked too. Written across her breasts in a shade of lipstick known as Peppermint Yum Yum are three damning words, "Daddy's little girl." "I have to wake up," she thinks. "I'll die of shame if I don't." But she doesn't, at least not right away. She looks up and sees that Gerald's knowing, disconcerting smile has turned into a gaping wound. Suddenly the stray dog's blood-soaked snout pokes out between his teeth. The dog is also grinning, and the head that comes shoving out between its fangs, like the onset of some obscene birth, belongs to her father. His eyes, always a bright blue, are now gray and haggard above his grin. They are Olivia's eyes, she realizes, and then she realizes something else as well. The flat mineral smell of lake water, so bland and yet so horrible, is everywhere. "I love too hard," my friends sometimes say, her father sings from inside the mouth of the dog, which is inside the mouth of the husband. "But I believe, that a woman should be loved that way." She casts the mallet aside and runs, screaming. As she passes the horrible creature with its bizarre chain of nested heads, Gerald snaps one of the handcuffs around her wrist. "Got you," he yells triumphantly. "Got you, me proud beauty." At first, she thinks the eclipse must not have been total yet after all, because the day has begun to grow still darker. Then it occurs to her that she is probably fainting. This thought is accompanied by feelings of deep relief and gratitude. "Don't be silly, Jess. You can't faint in a dream." But she thinks she may be doing just that. And in the end, it doesn't matter much whether it is a faint or only a deeper cave of sleep toward which she is fleeing, like the survivor of some cataclysm. What matters is that she is finally escaping the dream which has assaulted her in a much more fundamental way than her father's act on the deck that day. She is finally escaping, and gratitude seems like a beautifully normal response to these circumstances. She has almost made it into that comforting cave of darkness when a sound intrudes. A splintery, ugly sound like a loud spasm of coughing. She tries to flee the sound and finds she cannot. It has her like a hook, and like a hook it begins to pull her up toward the vast but fragile silver sky that separates sleep from consciousness. The former prince, who had once been the pride and joy of young Catherine Sutton, sat in the kitchen entryway for about 10 minutes after its latest foray into the bedroom. It sat with its head up, its eyes wide and unblinking. It had been existing on very short commons over the last 2 months. It had fed well this evening, gorged, in fact, and it should have been feeling logy and sleepy. It had been both for a while, but now all sleepiness had departed. What replaced it was a feeling of nervousness which grew steadily worse. Something had snapped several of the hair-thin tripwires posted in that mystical zone where the dog's senses and its intuition overlapped. The bitchmaster continued to moan in the other room and to make occasional talking noises, but her sounds were not the source of the stray's jitters. They were not what had caused it to sit up when it had been on the verge of drifting placidly off to sleep, and not the reason why its good ear was now cocked alertly forward, and its muzzle had wrinkled back far enough to show the tips of its teeth. It was something else. Something not right. Something which was possibly dangerous. As Jessie's dream peaked and then began to spiral down into darkness, the dog suddenly scrambled to its feet, unable to bear the steady sizzle in its nerves any longer. It turned, pushed open the loose back door with its snout, and jumped out into the windy dark. As it did, some strange and unidentifiable scent came to it. There was danger in that scent, almost certainly danger. The dog raced for the woods as fast as its swollen, overloaded belly would allow. When it had gained the safety of the undergrowth, it turned and squirmed a little way back toward the house. It had retreated, true enough, but a great many more alarm bells would have to go off inside before it would consider completely abandoning the wonderful supply of food it had found. Safely hidden, its thin, weary, intelligent face crisscrossed with overlapping ideograms of moon shadow, the stray began to bark, and it was this sound which eventually drew Jesse back to consciousness. During their summers on the lake in the early 60s, before William was able to do much more than paddle in the shallows with a pair of bright orange water wings attached to his back, Maddie and Jesse, always good friends despite the difference in their ages, often went down to swim at the Niedermeyers. The Niedermeyers had a float equipped with a diving platform, and it was there that Jesse began to develop the form which won her a place first on her high school swim team and then on the All-State team in 1971. What she remembered second best about diving from the board on the Niedermeyers float, first for then and always, was the swoop through the hot summer air toward the blue glitter of the waiting water, was how it felt to come up from the depths through conflicting layers of warm and cold. Coming up from her troubled sleep was like that. First there was a black, roaring confusion that was like being inside a thundercloud. She bumped and yawed her way through it, not having the slightest idea of who she was or when she was, let alone where she was. Then a warmer, calmer layer. She had been caught in the most awful nightmare in all of recorded history, at least in her recorded history. But a nightmare was all it had been, and now it was over. As the surface neared, however, she encountered another chilly layer, an idea that the reality waiting ahead was almost as bad as the nightmare. Maybe worse. "What is it?" she asked herself. "What could possibly be worse than what I've just been through?" She refused to think about that. The answer was within reach, but if it occurred to her, she might decide to flip over and start finning her way back down into the depths again. To do that would be to drown, and while drowning might not be the worst way to step out, not as bad as running your Harley into a rock wall, or parachuting into a cat's cradle of high-voltage wires, for instance, the idea of opening her body to that flat mineral smell, which reminded her simultaneously of copper and oysters, was insupportable. Jessie kept stroking grimly upward, telling herself that she would worry about reality when and if she actually broke the surface. The last layer she passed through was as warm and fearful as freshly spilled blood. Her arms were probably going to be deader than stumps. She just hoped she would be able to command enough movement in them to get the blood flowing again. Jessie gasped, jerked, and opened her eyes. She hadn't the slightest idea of how long she'd been asleep, and the clock radio on the dresser, stuck in its own hell of obsessive repetition, 12:12:12 it flashed into the darkness, as if time had stopped forever at midnight, was no help. All she knew for sure was that it was full dark, and the moon was now shining through the skylight instead of the east window. Her arms were jumping with a nervous jitter-jive of pins and needles. She usually disliked that feeling intensely, but not now. It was 1,000 times better than the muscle cramp she had expected as the price of waking her dead extremities back up. A moment or two later, she noticed a spreading dampness beneath her legs and bottom, and realized that her previous need to urinate was gone. Her body had taken care of the problem while she slept. She doubled her fists and pulled herself cautiously up a little, wincing at the pain in her wrists and the deep sobbing ache the movement caused in the backs of her hands. Most of that pain's a result of trying to slip out of the cuffs, she thought. You got nobody to blame but yourself, sweetheart. The dog had begun to bark again. Each shrill cry was like a splinter pounded into her eardrum, and she realized that sound was what had pulled her up and out of her sleep just as she had been about to dive below the nightmare. The location of the sounds told her the dog was back outside. She was glad it had left the house, but a little puzzled as well. Maybe it just hadn't been comfortable under a roof after spending such a long time outside. That idea made a certain amount of sense, as much as anything else in this situation, anyway. Get it together, Jess, she advised herself in a solemn, sleep-foggy voice. And maybe, just maybe, she was doing that. The panic and unreasoning shame she'd felt in the dream were departing. The dream itself seemed to be drying out, taking on the curiously desiccated quality of an overexposed photograph. Soon, she realized, it would be gone entirely. Dreams on waking were like the empty cocoons of moths, or the split-open husks of milkweed pods, dead shells where life had briefly swirled in furious but fragile storm systems. There had been times when this amnesia, if that's what it was, had struck her as sad. Not now. She had never in her life equated forgetting with mercy so quickly and completely. And it doesn't matter, she thought. It was just a dream after all. I mean, all those heads sticking out of heads. Dreams are supposed to be symbolic, of course. Yes, I know. And I suppose there might have been some symbolism in this one. Maybe even some truth. If nothing else, I think that now I understand why I hit Will when he goosed me that day. Nora Callaghan would undoubtedly be thrilled. She'd call it a breakthrough. Probably it is. It doesn't do a thing about getting me out of this fucking jailhouse jewelry, though. That's still my top priority. Does anyone disagree with that? Neither Ruth nor Goody replied. The UFO voices were likewise silent. The only response, in fact, came from her stomach, which was sorry as hell all this had happened, but still felt compelled to protest the cancellation of supper with a long, low rumble. Funny, in a way, but apt to be less so come tomorrow. By then her thirst would have come raging back, too, and she was under no illusions about how long those last two sips of water would stave it off. I've got to center my concentration. I've just got to. The problem isn't food, and it isn't water, either. Right now, those things matter as little as why I punched Will in the mouth at his 9th birthday party. The problem is how I'm... Her thoughts broke off with a clean snap of a knot exploding in a hot fire. Her eyes, which had been wandering aimlessly across the darkened room, locked on the far corner, where the wind-driven shadows of the pines danced wildly in the nacreous light falling through the skylight. There was a man standing there. Terror, greater than any she had ever known, crept over her. An emotion so strong that she felt it must soon burst her heart wide open. Her bladder, which had in fact only relieved the worst of its discomfort, now voided itself in a painless gush of heat. Jessie hadn't the slightest idea of that or anything else. Her terror had blown her mind temporarily clean from wall to wall and ceiling to floor. No sound escaped her, not even the smallest squeak. She was as incapable of sound as she was of thought. The muscles of her neck, shoulders, and arms turned to something that felt like warm water, and she slid down the headboard until she hung from the handcuffs in a kind of slack swoon. She didn't black out, didn't even come close to it, but that mental emptiness and the total physical incapacity which accompanied it were worse than a blackout. When thought did attempt to return, it was at first blocked by a dark, featureless wall of fear. A man. A man in the corner. She could see his dark eyes gazing at her with fixed, idiotic attention. She could see the waxy whiteness of his narrow cheeks and high forehead, although the intruder's actual features were blurred by the diorama of shadows which went flying across them. She could see slumped shoulders and dangling, ape-like arms which ended in long hands. She sensed feet somewhere in the black triangle of shadow thrown by the bureau, but that was all. She had no idea how long she lay in that horrible semi-swoon, paralyzed but aware, like a beetle stung by a trapdoor spider. It seemed like a very long time. The seconds dripped by, and she found herself unable to even close her eyes, let alone avert them from her strange guest. Her first terror of him began to abate a little, but what replaced it was somehow worse. Horror, and an unreasoning, atavistic revulsion. Jesse later thought that the wellspring of these feelings, the most powerful negative emotions she had ever experienced in her life, including those which had swept her only a short time before as she had watched the stray dog preparing to dine on Gerald, was the creature's utter stillness. It had crept in here while she slept, and now merely stood in the corner, camouflaged by the ceaseless ebb and flow of shadows over its face and body, staring at her with its strangely avid black eyes, eyes so large and rapt they reminded her of the sockets in a skull. Her visitor only stood there in the corner, merely that and nothing more. She lay in the handcuffs with her arms stretched above her, feeling like a woman at the bottom of a deep well. Time passed, marked only by the idiot blink of the clock proclaiming it was 12:12:12, and at last a coherent thought stole back into her brain, one which seemed both dangerous and vastly comforting. There's no one here but you, Jesse. The man you see in the corner is a combination of shadows and imagination. No more than that. She fought her way back to a sitting position, pulling with her arms, grimacing at the pain in her overtaxed shoulders, pushing with her feet, trying to dig her bare heels into the coverlet, breathing in harsh little blurts of effort. And while doing these things, her eyes never left the hideously elongated shape in the corner. It's too tall and too thin to be a real man, Jess. You see that, don't you? It's nothing but wind, shadows, and a soupçon of moonlight. And a few leftovers from your nightmare, I imagine. Okay? It almost was. She started to relax. Then, from outside, the dog voiced another hysterical volley of barks. And didn't the figure in the corner, the figure that was nothing but wind, shadows, and a soupçon of moonlight, didn't that non-existent figure turn its head slightly in that direction? No, surely not. Surely that was just another trick of the wind and the dark and the shadows. That might well be. In fact, she was almost sure that part, the head-turning part, had been an illusion. But the rest of it? The figure itself? She could not quite convince herself that it was all imagination. Surely no figure which looked that much like a man could be just an illusion. Could it? Goodwife Burlingame spoke up suddenly, and although her voice was fearful, there was no hysteria in it, at least not yet. Oddly, it was the Ruth part of her which had suffered the most extreme horror at the idea she might not be alone in the room, and it was the Ruth part that was still close to gibbering. "If that thing's not real," Goody said, "why did the dog leave in the first place? I don't think it would have done that without a very good reason, do you?" Yet she understood that Goody was deeply frightened just the same, and yearning for some explanation of the dog's departure that didn't include the shape Jesse either saw or thought she saw standing in the corner. Goody was begging her to say that her original idea, that the dog had left simply because it no longer felt comfortable in the house, was much more likely. Or maybe she thought it had left for the oldest reason of all. It had smelled another stray, this one a bitch in heat. She supposed it was even possible that the dog had been spooked by some noise, a branch knocking against an upstairs window, say. She liked that one the best, because it suggested a kind of rough justice, that the dog had also been spooked by some imaginary intruder, and its barks were intended to frighten this non-existent newcomer away from its pariah's supper. "Yes, say any of those things," Goody suddenly begged her. "And even if you can't believe any of them yourself, make me believe them." But she didn't think she could do that, and the reason was standing in the corner beside the bureau. There was someone there. It wasn't a hallucination made of moonlight. It wasn't a combination of wind-driven shadows and her own imagination. It wasn't a holdover from her dream, a momentary phantom glimpsed in the perceptual no-man's land between sleeping and waking. It was a monster. It's a monster, a boogie monster come to eat me up. Man. Not a monster, but a man. Standing there motionlessly and watching her while the wind gusted, making the house creak and the shadows dance across its strange, half-glimpsed face. This time the thought, monster, boogie monster, rose from the lower levels of her mind to the more brightly lit stage of her consciousness. She denied it again, but she could feel her terror returning just the same. The creature on the far side of the room might be a man, but even if it was, she was becoming more and more sure that there was something very wrong with its face. If only she could see it better. You wouldn't want to, a whispery, ominous UFO voice advised her. But I have to talk to it. I have to establish contact, Jessie thought, and immediately responded to herself in a nervous, scolding voice that felt like Ruth and Goody mixed together. Don't think of it as an it, Jessie. Think of it as a he. Think of it as a man. Someone who's maybe lost in the woods. Someone who's as scared as you are. Good advice, perhaps. But Jessie found she couldn't think of the figure in the corner as a he, any more than she was able to think of the stray as a he. Nor did she think the creature in the shadows was either lost or frightened. What she felt coming from the corner were long, slow waves of malevolence. That's stupid. Talk to it, Jessie. Talk to him. She tried to clear her throat and discovered there was nothing to clear. It was as dry as a desert and as smooth as soapstone. Now she could feel her heart pounding in her chest. Its beat very light, very fast, very irregular. The wind gusted. The shadows blew white and black patterns across the walls and the ceiling, making her feel like a woman trapped inside a kaleidoscope for the colorblind. For just a moment, she thought she saw a nose, thin and long and white, below those black, motionless eyes. Ooh. At first, she could manage only that one tiny whisper, which couldn't have been heard on the far side of the bed, let alone across the room. She stopped, licked her lips, and tried again. She was aware that her hands were clamped into painfully tight balls, and she forced her fingers to loosen. Who are you? Still a whisper, but a little better than before. The figure didn't answer, only stood there with its narrow white hands dangling by its knees. And Jessie thought, its knees? Knees? Not possible, Jess. When a person's hands are hanging at his sides, they stop at the upper thighs. Ruth responded, her voice so hushed and fearful Jessie almost didn't recognize it. A normal person's hands stop at the upper thighs. Isn't that what you mean? But do you think a normal person would creep into someone's house in the middle of the night, then just stand in the corner watching when he finds the lady of the manor chained to the bed? Just stand there and nothing more? Then it did move, one leg. Or perhaps it was only the distracting motion of the shadows again, this time picked up by the lower quadrant of her vision. The combination of shadows and moonlight and wind lent a terrible ambiguity to this entire episode, and again Jessie found herself doubting the visitor's reality. The possibility that she was still sleeping occurred to her, that her dream of Will's birthday party had simply veered off in some strange new direction, but she didn't really believe it. She was awake, all right. Whether or not the leg actually did move, or even if there was a leg, Jessie's gaze was momentarily drawn downward. She thought she saw some black object sitting on the floor between the creature's feet. It was impossible to tell what it might be, because the bureau's shadow rendered that the darkest part of the room. But her mind suddenly returned to that afternoon, when she had been trying to persuade Gerald that she really meant what she was saying. The only sounds had been the wind, the banging door, the barking dog, the loon, and... The thing sitting on the floor between her visitor's feet was a chainsaw. Jessie was instantly sure of this. Her visitor had been using it earlier, but not to cut firewood. It was people he had been cutting up, and the dog had run because it had smelled the approach of this madman, who had come up the lake path swinging his blood-spattered still saw in one gloved hand. "Stop it!" Goody shouted angrily. "Stop this foolishness right this minute and get a grip on yourself!" But she discovered she couldn't stop it, because this was no dream, and also because she had become increasingly sure that the figure standing in the corner, as silent as Frankenstein's monster before the lightning bolts, was real. But even if it was, it hadn't spent the afternoon turning people into pork chops with a chainsaw. Of course not. That was nothing but a movie-inspired variation of the simple, gruesome summer camp tales that seemed so funny when you were gathered around the fire, roasting marshmallows with the rest of the girls, and so awful later on, when you lay shivering in your sleeping bag, believing that each snapping twig signaled the approach of the Lakeview man, that legendary brain-blasted survivor of the Korean War. The thing standing in the corner wasn't the Lakeview man, and it wasn't a chainsaw murderer either. There was something on the floor. At least she was pretty sure there was. And Jessie supposed it could be a chainsaw. But it could also be a suitcase, a backpack, a salesman's sample case, or my imagination. Yes. Even though she was looking right at it, whatever it was, she knew she couldn't rule out the possibility of imagination. Yet in some perverse way, this only reinforced the idea that the creature itself was real, and it was becoming harder and harder to dismiss the feeling of malevolence which came crawling out of the tangle of black shadows and powdery moonlight like a constant low snarl. "It hates me," she thought. "Whatever it is, it hates me. It must. Why else would it just stand there and not help me?" She looked back up at that half-seen face, at the eyes which seemed to glitter with such feverish avidity in their round black sockets, and she began to weep. "Please, is there someone there?" Her voice was humble, choked with tears. "If there is, won't you please help me? Do you see these handcuffs? The keys are right there beside you on the top of the bureau." Nothing. No movement. No response. It only stood there, if it was there at all, that was, looking out at her from behind its feral mask of shadows. "If you didn't want me to tell anyone I saw you, I wouldn't," she tried again. Her voice wavered, blurred, swooped, and slid. "I sure wouldn't. And I'd be so, so grateful." It watched her. Only that and nothing more. Jessie felt the tears rolling slowly down her cheeks. "You're scaring me, you know," she said. "Won't you say something? Can't you talk? If you're really there, can't you please talk to me?" A thin, terrible hysteria seized her then, and flew away with some valuable, irreplaceable part of her, caught firmly in its scrawny talons. She wept and pleaded with a fearful figure standing motionless in the corner of the bedroom. She remained conscious throughout, but sometimes wavered into that curious blank place reserved for those whose terror had become so great it approaches rapture. She would hear herself asking the figure in a hoarse, weepy voice to please let her out of the handcuffs, to please, oh, please, let her out of the handcuffs. and then she would drop back into that weird blank spot. She knew her mouth was still moving because she could feel it. She could also hear the sounds that were coming out of it. But while she was in the blank place, these sounds were not words, but only loose, blabbering torrents of sound. She could also hear the wind blowing and the dog barking, aware but not knowing, hearing but not understanding, losing everything in her horror of the half-seen shape, the awful visitor, the uninvited guest. She could not cease her contemplation of its narrow, misshapen head, its white cheeks, its slumped shoulders. But more and more it was the creature's hands to which her eyes were drawn. Those dangling, long-fingered hands that ended much further down on the legs than normal hands had any right to do. Some unknown length of time would pass in this blank fashion. 12:12:12, the clock on the dresser reported. No help there. And then she would come back a little, would start thinking thoughts instead of experiencing only an endless rush of incoherent images, would start hearing her lips speaking words instead of just babbling sounds. But she had moved on while she was in that blank space. Her words now had nothing to do with the handcuffs or the keys on the dresser. What she heard instead was the thin, screamy whisper of a woman reduced to begging for an answer. Any answer. "What are you?" she sobbed. "A man? A devil? What in God's name are you?" The wind gusted. The door banged. Before her, the figure's face seemed to change, seemed to wrinkle upward in a grin. There was something horribly familiar about that grin, and Jessie felt the core of her sanity, which had borne this assault with remarkable strength until now, at last begin to waver. "Daddy," she whispered. "Daddy, is that you?" "Don't be silly," the good wife cried. But Jessie could now feel even that sustaining voice wavering toward hysteria. "Don't be a goose, Jessie. Your father has been dead since 1980. Instead of helping, it made things worse. Much worse. Tom Mayhoot had been interred in the family crypt in Falmouth, and that was less than 100 miles from here. Jessie's burning, terrified mind insisted upon showing her a hunched figure, its clothes and rotted shoes caked with blue-green mold, slinking across moon-drenched fields and hurrying through tracts of scruffy woods between suburban housing developments. She saw gravity working on the decayed muscles of its arms as it came, gradually stretching them until the hands were swinging beside the knees. It was her father. It was the man who delighted her with rides on his shoulders at 3, who had comforted her at the age of 6 when a capering circus clown frightened her into tears, who had told her bedtime stories until she was 8, old enough, he said, to read them on her own. Her father, who had cobbled together homemade filters on the afternoon of the eclipse and held her on his lap as the moment of totality approached. Her father, who had said, "Don't worry about anything. Don't worry. And don't look around." But she had thought maybe he was worried, because his voice had been all thick and shaky, hardly like his usual voice at all. In the corner, the thing's grin seemed to widen, and suddenly the room was filled with that smell, that flat smell that was half metallic and half organic, a smell that reminded her of oysters and cream, and how your hand smelled after you'd been clutching a fistful of pennies, and the way the air smelled just before a thunderstorm. "Daddy, is it you?" she asked the shadowy thing in the corner. And from somewhere came the distant cry of the loon. Jessie could feel the tears trickling slowly down her cheeks. And now something exceedingly odd was happening, something she never would have expected in 1,000 years. As she became increasingly sure that it was her father, that it was Tom Mayhoot standing in the corner, 12 years gone in death or not, her terror began to leave her. She had drawn her legs up, but now she let them slip back down and fall open. As she did, a fragment of her dream recurred. Daddy's little girl printed across her breasts in peppermint yum-yum lipstick. All right. Go ahead, she told the shape. Her voice was a little hoarse, but otherwise steady. It's why you came back, isn't it? So go ahead. How could I stop you anyway? Just promise you'll unlock me afterward. That you'll unlock me and let me go. The figure made no response of any kind. It only stood within its surreal jackstraws of moonlight and shadow, grinning at her. And as the seconds passed, 12, 12, 12, the clock of the dresser said, seeming to suggest that the whole idea of time passing was an illusion, that time had in fact frozen solid, Jessie began to think she had been right in the first place, that there was really no one in here with her at all. She had begun to feel like a weather vane, in the grip of those prankish, contradictory gusts of wind that sometimes blow just before a severe thunderstorm or a tornado. Your father cannot come back from the dead, Goodwife Burlingame said in a voice that strove to be firm, but failed miserably. Still, Jessie saluted her effort. Come hell or high water, the goodwife stayed right in there and kept pitching. This isn't a horror movie or an episode of The Twilight Zone, Jess. This is real life. But another part of her, the part which was perhaps the home of those few voices inside which were the real UFOs, not just the wiretaps her subconscious had patched into her conscious mind at some point, insisted that there was a darker truth here, something that trailed from the heels of logic like an irrational, and perhaps supernatural, shadow. This voice insisted that things changed in the dark. Things especially changed in the dark, it said, when a person was alone. When that happened, the locks fell off the cage which held the imagination, and anything, any things, might be set free. It can be your daddy, this essentially alien part of her whispered. And with a chill of fear, Jessie recognized it as the voice of madness and reason mingled together. It can be. Never doubt it. People are almost always safe from ghosts and ghouls and the living dead in daylight. And they're usually safe from them at night, if they're with others. But when a person is alone in the dark, all bets are off. Men and women alone in the dark are like open doors, Jessie. And if they call out or scream for help, who knows what dread things may answer? Who knows what some men and women have seen in the hour of their solitary deaths? Is it so hard to believe that some of them may have died of fear? No matter what the words on the death certificate say. I don't believe that, she said in a blurry, wavering voice. She spoke louder, striving for a firmness she didn't feel. You're not my father. I don't think you're anyone. I think you're only made of moonlight. As if in answer, the figure bent forward in a kind of mocking bow, and for one moment its face, a face which seemed too real to doubt, slipped out of the shadows. Jessie uttered a rusty shriek as the pallid rays falling through the skylight painted its features with tawdry carnival gilt. It wasn't her father. Compared with the evil and the lunacy she saw in the face of her visitor, she would have welcomed her father, even after 12 years in a cold coffin. Red-rimmed, hideously sparkling eyes regarded her from deep eye sockets wrapped in wrinkles. Thin lips twitched upward in a dry grin, revealing discolored molars and jagged canines which seemed almost as long as the stray dog's fangs. One of its white hands lifted the object she had half seen and half intuited sitting by its feet in the darkness. At first, she thought it had taken Gerald's briefcase from the room he used as a study down here. But when the creature lifted the box-shaped thing into the light, she saw it was a lot bigger than Gerald's briefcase and much older. It looked like the sort of old-fashioned sample case traveling salesmen had once carried. "Please," she whispered in a strengthless, wheezing little voice. "Whatever you are, please don't hurt me. You don't have to let me go if you don't want to, that's all right. But please don't hurt me." Its grin grew, and she saw tiny twinkles far back in its mouth. Her visitor apparently had gold teeth, or gold fillings in there, just like Gerald. It seemed to laugh soundlessly, as if gratified by her terror. Then its long fingers were unsnapping the catches of its bag. "I am dreaming, I think. Now it does feel like a dream. Oh, thank God it does." And holding it open to her. The case was full of bones and jewelry. She saw finger bones and rings and teeth and bracelets and ulnai and pendants. She saw a diamond big enough to choke a rhino, glittering milky trapezoids of moonlight from within the stiff, delicate curves of an infant's ribcage. She saw these things and wanted them to be a dream, yes, wanted them to be. But if it was, it was like no dream she'd ever had before. It was the situation, handcuffed to the bed while a half-seen maniac silently showed off his treasures, that was dreamlike. The feeling, however, the feeling was reality. There was no getting around it. The feeling was reality. The thing standing in the corner held the open case out for her inspection, one hand supporting the bottom. It plunged its other hand into the tangle of bones and jewelry and stirred it, producing a tenebrous click and rustle that sounded like dirt-clogged castanets. It stared at her as it did this, the somehow unformed features of its strange face wrinkled upward in amusement, its mouth gawping in that silent grin, its slumped shoulders rising and falling in strangled chuffs of laughter. "No!" Jessie screamed. But no sound came out. Suddenly she felt someone, most likely the goodwife, and boy had she ever underestimated the intestinal fortitude of that lady, running for the switches which governed the circuit breakers in her head. Goody had seen tendrils of smoke starting to seep out through the cracks in the closed doors of those panels, had understood what they meant, and was making a final, desperate effort to shut down the machinery before the motors overheated and the bearings froze. The grinning figure across the room reached deeper into the case and held out a handful of bones and gold to Jessie in the moonlight. There was an intolerably bright flash inside her head, and then the lights went out. She did not faint prettily, like the heroine in a florid stage play, but was snapped brutally backward, like a condemned murderer who has been strapped into the hot seat and has just gotten his first jolt of the juice. All the same, it was an end to the horror, and for the time being, that was enough. Jessie Burlingame went into the darkness without a murmur of protest. She struggled briefly back to consciousness some time later, aware of only two things. The moon had made it around to the west windows, and she was terribly afraid. Of what, she at first didn't know. Then it came to her. Daddy had been here, was perhaps here still. The creature hadn't looked like him, that was true, but that was only because Daddy had been wearing his eclipse face. Jessie struggled up, pushing with her feet so hard she shoved the coverlet down beneath her. She wasn't able to do much with her arms, however. The jittering pins and needles had stolen away while she'd been unconscious, and they had no more feeling than a couple of chair legs. She stared into the corner by the bureau with wide, moon-silvered eyes. The wind had died, and the shadows were, at least for the time being, still. There was nothing in the corner. Her dark visitor had gone. Maybe not Jess. Maybe he's just changed location. Maybe he's hiding under the bed. How's that for a thought? If he is, he could reach up at any second and put one of his hands on your hip. The wind stirred. Only a puff, not a gust. And the back door banged weakly. Those were the only sounds. The dog had fallen silent. And it was this more than anything else which convinced her that the stranger was gone. She had the house to herself. Jessie's gaze dropped to the large dark blob on the floor. Correction, she thought. There's Gerald. Can't forget about him. She put her head back and closed her eyes, aware of a steady low pulse in her throat, not wanting to wake up enough for that pulse to transform itself into what it really was, thirst. She didn't know if she could go from black unconsciousness to ordinary sleep or not, but she knew that was what she wanted, more than anything else, except perhaps for someone to drive down here and rescue her. She wanted to sleep. There was no one here, Jessie. You know that, don't you? It was absurdity of absurdities, Ruth's voice. Tough-talking Ruth, whose stated motto, cribbed from a Nancy Sinatra song, was, "One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you." Ruth, who had been reduced to a pile of quivering jelly by the shape in the moonlight. "Go ahead, Toots," Ruth said. "Make fun of me all you want. Maybe I even deserve it. But don't kid yourself. There was no one here." "Your imagination put on a little slideshow, that's all. That's all there was to it." "You're wrong, Ruth," Goody responded calmly. "Someone was here, all right. And Jessie and I both know who it was. It didn't exactly look like Daddy, but that was only because he had his eclipse face on. The face wasn't the important part, though, or how tall he looked. He might have had on boots with special high heels, or maybe he was wearing shoes with lifts in them. For all I know, he could have been on stilts." "Stilts!" Ruth cried, amazed. "Oh, dear God, now I've heard everything. Never mind the fact that the man died before Reagan's Inauguration Day tucks got back from the cleaners. Tom Mayhew was so clumsy, he should have had walking downstairs insurance." "Stilts? Oh, babe, you have got to be putting me on." "That part doesn't matter," Goody said with a kind of serene stubbornness. "It was him. I'd know that smell anywhere. That thick, blood-warm smell. Not the smell of oysters or pennies. Not even the smell of blood. The smell of..." The thought broke up and drifted away. Jessie slept. She ended up alone with her father at Sunset Trails on the afternoon of July 20th, 1963, for two reasons. One was a cover for the other. The cover was her claim that she was still a little frightened of Mrs. Gillette, even though it had been at least 5 years, and probably closer to six, since the incident of the cookie and the slapped hand. The real reason was simple and uncomplicated. It was her daddy she wanted to be with during such a special, once-in-a-lifetime event. Her mother had suspected as much, and being moved around like a chess piece by her husband and her 10-year-old daughter hadn't pleased her, but by then the matter was practically a fait accompli. Jessie had gone to her daddy first. She was still 4 months away from her 11th birthday, but that didn't make her a fool. What Sally Mayhew suspected was true. Jessie had launched a conscious, carefully thought-out campaign which would allow her to spend the day of the eclipse with her father. Much later, Jessie would think that this was yet another reason to keep her mouth shut about what happened on that day. There might be those, her mother, for instance, who would say that she had no right to complain, that she had in fact gotten about what she deserved. On the day before the eclipse, Jessie had found her father sitting on the deck outside his den and reading a paperback copy of Profiles in Courage, while his wife, son, and elder daughter laughed and swam in the lake below. He smiled at her when she took the seat next to him, and Jessie smiled back. She had brightened her mouth with lipstick for this interview. Peppermint yum-yum, in fact. A birthday present from Maddie. Jessie hadn't liked it when she first tried it on. She thought it a baby shade, and that it tasted like Pepsodent. But Daddy had said he thought it was pretty, and that had transformed it into the most valuable of her few cosmetic resources, something to be treasured and used only on special occasions like this one. He listened carefully and respectfully as she spoke, but he made no particular attempt to disguise the glint of amused skepticism in his eyes. "Do you really mean to tell me you're still afraid of Adrian Gillette?" he asked when she had finished rehashing the oft-told tale of how Mrs. Gillette had slapped her hand when she had reached for the last cookie on the plate. "That must have been back in... I don't know, I was still working for Dunninger, so it must have been before 1959. And you're still spooked all these years later? How absolutely Freudian, my dear." "Well, you know, just a little." She widened her eyes, trying to communicate the idea that she was saying a little but meaning a lot. In truth, she didn't know if she was still scared of old poo-poo breath or not. But she did know she considered Mrs. Gillette a boring old blue-haired booger, and she had no intention of spending the only total eclipse of the sun she'd probably ever see in her company if she could possibly work things around so she could watch it with her daddy, whom she adored beyond the power of words to tell. She evaluated his skepticism and concluded with relief that it was friendly, perhaps even conspiratorial. She smiled and added, "But I also wanted to stay with you." He raised her hand to his mouth and kissed her fingers like a French monsieur. He hadn't shaved that day. He often didn't when he was at camp. And the rough scrape of his whiskers sent a pleasurable shiver of goosebumps up her arms and back. "Come to a douce," he said. "Ma jolie, mademoiselle, je t'aime." She giggled, not understanding his clumsy French, but suddenly sure it was all going to work out just the way she had hoped it would. "It'd be fun," she said happily. "Just the two of us. I could make an early supper and we could eat it right here on the deck." He grinned. "Eclipse burgers à deux?" She laughed, nodding and clapping her hands with delight. Then he had said something that struck her as a little odd even at the time, because he was not a man who cared much about clothes and fashions. "You could wear your pretty new sundress." "Sure, if you want," she said, although she had already made a mental note to ask her mother to try and exchange the sundress. It was pretty enough, if you weren't offended by red and yellow stripes almost bright enough to shout, that was. But it was also too small and too tight. Her mother had ordered it from Sears, going mostly by guess and by gosh, filling in a single size larger than that which had fit Jessie the year before. As it happened, she had grown a little faster than that, in a number of ways. Still, if Daddy liked it, and if he would come over to her side of this eclipse business and help her push. He did come over to her side, and pushed like Hercules himself. He began that night, suggesting to his wife after dinner, and two or three mellowing glasses of vin rouge, that Jessie be excused from tomorrow's eclipse watch outing to the top of Mount Washington. Most of their summer neighbors were going. Just after Memorial Day, they'd begun having informal meetings on the subject of how and where to watch the upcoming solar phenomenon. To Jessie, these meetings had seemed like ordinary run-of-the-mill summer cocktail parties, and had even given themselves a name, the Dark Score Sun Worshippers. The Sun Worshippers had rented one of the school district's minibuses for the occasion, and were planning to voyage to the top of New Hampshire's tallest mountain, equipped with box lunches, Polaroid sunglasses, specially constructed reflector boxes, specially filtered cameras, and champagne, of course. Lots and lots of champagne. To Jessie's mother and older sister, All this had seemed to be the very definition of frothy, sophisticated fun. To Jesse, it had seemed the essence of all that was boring, and that was before you added poo-poo breath into the equation. She had gone out on the deck after supper on the evening of the 19th, presumably to read 20 or 30 pages of Mr. C.S. Lewis's Out of the Silent Planet before the sun went down. Her actual purpose was a good deal less intellectual. She wanted to listen as her father made his, their pitch, and to silently root him on. She and Mattie had been aware for years that the combination living room-dining room of the summer house had peculiar acoustical qualities, probably caused by its high, steeply angled ceiling. Jesse had an idea that even Will knew about the way sound carried from in there to out here on the deck. Only their parents seemed unaware that the room might as well have been bugged, and that most of the important decisions they had made in that room as they sipped after-dinner cognac or cups of coffee were known, to their daughters at least, long before the marching orders were handed down from staff headquarters. Jesse noticed that she was holding the Lewis novel upside down, and made haste to rectify that situation before Mattie happened by and gave her a big, silent horse laugh. She felt a little guilty about what she was doing. It was a lot closer to eavesdropping than to rooting when you got right down to it, but not quite guilty enough to stop. And in fact, she considered herself still to be on the right side of a thin moral line. After all, it wasn't as if she were hiding in the closet or anything. She was sitting right out here in full view, bathed in the bright light of the westering sun. She was sitting out here with her book, and wondering if there were ever eclipses on Mars, and if there were Martians up there to watch them if there were. If her parents thought no one could hear what they were saying just because they were sitting at the table and there, was that her fault? Was she supposed to go in and tell them?
"I don't think so, my dear," Jesse whispered in her snottiest Elizabeth Taylor cat on a hot tin roof voice, and then cupped her hands over a big, goofy grin. And she guessed she was also safe from her big sister's interference, at least for the time being. She could hear Mattie and Will below her in the rumpus room, squabbling good-naturedly over a game of cootie or parcheesi or something like that. "I really don't think it would hurt her to stay here with me tomorrow, do you?" her father was asking in his most winning, good-humored voice. "No, of course not," Jessie's mother replied. "But it wouldn't exactly kill her to go someplace with the rest of us this summer, either. She's turned into a complete daddy's girl. She went down to the puppet show in Bethel with you and Will last week. In fact, didn't you tell me that she stayed with Will, even bought him an ice cream out of her own allowance, while you went into that auction barn? That was no sacrifice for our Jesse," Sally replied. She sounded almost grim.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean she went to the puppet show because she wanted to, and she took care of Will because she wanted to." Grimness had given way to a more familiar tone, exasperation. "How can you understand what I mean?" that tone asked. "How can you possibly, when you're a man?" This was a tone Jesse had heard more and more frequently in her mother's voice these last few years. She knew that was partly because she herself heard more and saw more as she grew up, but she was pretty sure it was also because her mother used that tone more frequently than she once had. Jesse couldn't understand why her father's brand of logic always made her mother so crazy. "All of a sudden, the fact that she did something because she wanted to is a cause for concern?" Tom was now asking. "Maybe even a mark against her? What do we do if she develops a social conscience as well as a family one, Sal? Put her in a home for wayward girls?"
"Don't patronize me, Tom. You know perfectly well what I mean."
"Nope. This time you've lost me in the dust, sweet one. This is supposed to be our summer vacation, remember? And I've always sort of had the idea that when people are on vacation, they're supposed to do what they want to do and be with who they want to be with. In fact, I thought that was the whole idea."
Jesse smiled, knowing it was all over but the shouting. When the eclipse started tomorrow afternoon,
She was going to be here with her daddy, instead of on top of Mount Washington with poo-poo breath and the rest of the Dark Score sun worshippers. Her father was like some world-class chess master who had just given a talented amateur a run for her money and was now polishing her off.
You could come too, Tom. Jesse would come if you did.
That was a tricky one. Jesse held her breath. Can't, my love. I'm expecting a call from David Adams on the Brookings pharmaceutical portfolio. Very important stuff. Also very risky stuff. At this stage, handling Brookings is like handling blasting caps. But let me be honest with you. Even if I could, I'm not really sure I would. I'm not nuts about the Gillette woman, but I can get along with her. That asshole Sleaford, on the other hand.
Hush, Tom!
Don't worry, Maddie and Will are downstairs, and Jesse's way out on the front deck, see her? At that moment, Jesse suddenly became sure that her father knew exactly what the acoustics of the living room dining room were like. He knew that his daughter was hearing every word of this discussion, wanted her to hear every word. A warm little shiver traced its way up her back and down her legs.
I should have known it came down to Dick Sleaford.
Her mother sounded angrily amused, a combination that made Jesse's head spin. It seemed to her that only adults could combine emotions in so many daffy ways. If feelings were food, adult feelings would be things like chocolate-covered steak, mashed potatoes with pineapple bits, Special K with chili powder sprinkled on it instead of sugar. Jesse thought, and not for the first time, that being an adult seemed more like a punishment than a reward.
This is really exasperating, Tom. The man made a pass at me 6 years ago. He was drunk.
Back in those days, he was always drunk, but he's cleaned up his act. Polly Bergeron told me he goes to AA and...
Bully for him, her father said dryly. Do we send him a get-well card or a merit badge, Sally?
Don't be flip. You almost broke the man's nose.
Yes, indeed. When a fellow comes into a kitchen to freshen his drink and finds the rum-dum from up the road with one hand on his wife's behind and the other down the front of her...
Never mind, she said primly. But Jesse thought that for some reason her mother sounded almost pleased. Curiouser and curiouser. The point is, it's time you discovered that Dick Sleaford isn't a demon from the deeps. And it's time Jesse discovered Adrian Gillette is just a lonely old woman who once slapped her hand at a lawn party as a little joke. Now please don't get all crazy on me, Tom. I'm not claiming it was a good joke. It wasn't. I'm just saying that Adrian didn't know that. There was no bad intent.
Jesse looked down and saw her paperback novel was bent almost double in her right hand. How could her mother, a woman who'd graduated cum laude, whatever that meant, from Vassar, possibly be so stupid? The answer seemed clear enough to Jesse. She couldn't be. Either she knew better or she refused to see the truth. And you arrived at the same conclusion no matter which answer you decided was the right one. When forced to choose between believing the ugly old woman who lived up the road from them in the summertime and her own daughter, Sally Mayhoot had chosen poo-poo breath. Good deal, huh?
If I'm a daddy's girl, that's why. That and all the other stuff she says that's like that. That's why. But I could never tell her, and she'll never see it on her own. Never in a billion years.
Jessie forced herself to relax her grip on the paperback. Mrs. Gillette had meant it. There had been bad intent. But her father's suspicion that she had ceased being afraid of the old crow had probably been more right than wrong, just the same. Also, she was going to get her way about staying with her father, so none of her mother's S-H-I-T really mattered, did it? She was going to be here with her daddy. She wouldn't have to deal with old poo-poo breath, and these good things were going to happen because...
Because he sticks up for me, she murmured.
Yes, that was the bottom line. Her father stuck up for her, and her mother stuck it to her.
Jesse saw the evening star glowing mildly in the darkening sky, and suddenly realized she'd been out on the deck, listening to them circle the subject of the eclipse, and the subject of her, for almost 3/4 of an hour.
she discovered a minor but interesting fact of life that night. Time speeds by fastest when you are eavesdropping on conversations about yourself. With hardly a thought, she raised her hand and curled it into a tube, simultaneously catching the star and sending it the old formula, "Wish I may, wish I might." Her wish, already well on the way to being granted, was that she be allowed to stay here tomorrow with her daddy. To stay with him no matter what. Just two folks who knew how to stick up for each other, sitting out on the deck and eating Eclipseburgers à deux. More like an old married couple than father and daughter. As for Dick Sleaford, he apologized to me later, Tom. I don't remember if I ever told you that or not. You did. But I don't remember him ever apologizing to me. He was probably afraid you'd knock his block off. Or at least try to, Sally replied. Speaking again in that tone of voice Jesse found so peculiar. It seemed to be an uneasy mixture of happiness, good humor, and anger. Jesse wondered for just a moment if it was possible to sound that way and be completely sane, and then she squashed the thought quickly and completely. Also, I want to say one more thing about Adrian Gillette before we leave the subject entirely. Be my guest. She told me, in 1959, this was two whole summers later, that she went through the change that year. She never specifically mentioned Jesse and the cookie incident, but I think she was trying to apologize. Oh. It was her father's coolest, most lawyerly oh. And did either of you ladies think to pass that information on to Jesse and explain to her what it meant? Silence from her mother. Jesse, who still had only the vaguest notion of what going through the change meant, looked down and saw she had once again gripped the book tight enough to bend it, and once again forced herself to relax her hands. Or to apologize? His tone was gentle, caressing, deadly. Stop cross-examining me! Sally burst out after another long, considering silence. This is your home, not part two of Superior Court, in case you hadn't noticed. You brought the subject up, not me, he said. I just asked. Oh, I get so tired of the way you twist everything around, Sally said. Jesse knew from her tone of voice that she was either crying or getting ready to. For the first time that she could remember, the sound of her mother's tears called up no sympathy in her own heart, no urge to run in comfort, probably bursting into tears herself in the process. Instead, she felt a queer, stony satisfaction. Sally, you're upset. Why don't we just... Arguments with my husband have a way of doing that. Isn't that strange? Isn't that just the weirdest thing you ever heard? And do you know what we're arguing about? I'll give you a hint, Tom. It's not Adrian Gillette, and it's not Dick Sleaford, and it's not the eclipse tomorrow. We're arguing about Jesse. About our daughter. And what else is new? She laughed through her tears. There was a dry hiss as she scratched a match and lit a cigarette. Don't they say it's the squeaky wheel that always gets the grease? And that's our Jesse, isn't it? The squeaky wheel. Never quite satisfied with the arrangements until she gets a chance to put on the finishing touches. Never quite happy with someone else's plans. Never able to let well enough alone. Jesse was appalled to hear something very close to hate in her mother's voice. Sally, never mind, Tom. She wants to stay here with you? Fine. She wouldn't be pleasant to have along anyway. All she'd do is pick fights with her sister and whine about having to watch out for Will. All she'd do is squeak, in other words. Sally, Jesse hardly ever whines, and she's very good about... Oh, you don't see her! Sally Mayhoot cried, and the spite in her voice made Jesse cringe back in her chair. I swear to God, sometimes you behave as if she was your girlfriend instead of your daughter. This time the long pause belonged to her father, and when he spoke, his voice was soft and cold. That's a lousy, underhanded, unfair thing to say, he finally replied. Jesse sat on the deck, looking at the evening star and feeling dismay deepening toward something like horror. She felt a sudden urge to cup her hand and catch the star again, this time to wish everything away, beginning with her request to her daddy that he fix things so she could stay at Sunset Trails with him tomorrow. Then the sound of her mother's chair being pushed back came. "I apologize," Sally said. And although she still sounded angry, Jessie thought she now sounded a little afraid as well. "Keep her tomorrow, if that's what you want. Fine, good. You're welcome to her." Then the sound of her heels tapping rapidly away, and a moment later the snick of her father's Zippo as he lit his own cigarette. On the deck, Jessie felt warm tears spring to her eyes, tears of shame, hurt, and relief that the argument had ended before it could get any worse. For hadn't both she and Maddie noticed that their parents' arguments had gotten both louder and hotter just lately, that the coolness between them afterward was slower to warm up again? It wasn't possible, was it, that they... No, she interrupted herself before the thought could be completed. No, it's not. It's not possible at all, so just shut up. Perhaps a change of scene would induce a change of thought. Jessie got up, trotted down the back steps, then walked down the path to the lakefront. There she sat throwing pebbles into the water until her father came out to find her half an hour later. "Eclipse burgers for two on the deck tomorrow," he said, and kissed the side of her neck. He had shaved and his chin was smooth, but that small, delicious shiver went up her back again just the same. "It's all fixed." Was she mad? "Nope," said her father cheerfully. "Said it was fine by her either way, since you'd done all your chores this week, and..." She had forgotten her earlier intuition that he knew a lot more about the acoustics of the living room dining room than he had ever let on, and the generosity of his lie moved her so deeply that she almost burst into tears. She turned to him, threw her arms around his neck, and covered his cheeks and lips with fierce little kisses. His initial reaction was surprise. His hands jerked backward, and for just a moment they were cupping the tiny nubs of her breasts. That shivery feeling passed through her again, but this time it was much stronger, almost strong enough to be painful, like a shock. And with it, like some weird déjà vu, came that recurring sense of adulthood's strange contradictions, a world where you could order blackberry meatloaf or eggs fried in lemon juice whenever you wanted to, and where some people actually did. Then his hands slipped all the way around her. They were pressed safely against her shoulder blades, hugging her warmly against him. And if they had stayed where they shouldn't have been, a moment longer than they should have done, she barely noticed. "I love you, Daddy." "Love you too, Punkin. 100 million bunches." The day of the eclipse dawned hot and muggy, but relatively clear. The weather forecaster's warnings that low-hanging clouds might obscure the phenomenon were going to prove groundless, it seemed, at least in western Maine. Sally, Maddie, and Will left to catch the Dark Score Sun Worshippers bus at around 10 o'clock. Sally gave Jessie a stiff, silent peck on the cheek before leaving, and Jessie responded in kind, leaving Tom Mayhoop with a girl his wife had called the Squeaky Wheel the night before. Jessie changed out of her shorts and Camp Ossipee t-shirt and into her new sundress, the one which was pretty, if you weren't offended by red and yellow stripes almost bright enough to shout, that was, but too tight. She put on a dab of Maddie's Mycin perfume, a little of her mother's Yodora deodorant, and a fresh application of peppermint yum-yum lipstick. And although she had never been one to linger before the mirror, fussing with herself, that was her mother's term, as in, "Maddie, stop fussing with yourself and come out of there." She took time to put her hair up that day, because her father had once complimented her on that particular style. When she had put the last pin into place, she reached for the bathroom light switch, then paused. The girl looking back at her from the mirror didn't seem like a girl at all, but a teenager. It wasn't the way the sundress accentuated the tiny swellings that wouldn't really be breasts for another year or two. And it wasn't the lipstick. And it wasn't her hair, held up in a clumsy but oddly fetching chignon. It was all of these things together, a sum greater than its parts because of what? She didn't know. Something in the way the upsweep of her hair accented the shape of her cheekbones, perhaps, or the bare curve of her neck, so much sexier than either the mosquito bumps on her chest or the hipless tomboy's body. Or maybe it was just the look in her eyes, some sparkle that either had been hidden before today or had never been there at all. Whatever it was, it made her linger a moment longer, looking at a reflection, and suddenly she heard her mother saying, "I swear to God, sometimes you behave as if she was your girlfriend instead of your daughter." She bit her pink lower lip, brow furrowing a little, remembering the night before, the shiver that had gone through her at his touch, the feel of his hands on her breasts. She could feel that shiver trying to happen again, and she refused to let it. There was no sense shivering over stupid stuff you couldn't understand, or even thinking about it. Good advice, she thought, and turned off the bathroom light. She found herself growing more and more excited as noon passed and the afternoon drew along toward the actual time of the eclipse. She turned the portable radio to WNCH, the rock and roll station in North Conway. Her mother abhorred NCH, and after 30 minutes of Del Shannon and Dee Dee Sharp and Gary U.S. Bonds, would make whoever had tuned it in, usually Jesse or Maddie, but sometimes Will, change to the classical music station which broadcast from the top of Mount Washington. But her father actually seemed to enjoy the music today, snapping his fingers and humming along. Once during the Dupree's version of You Belong to Me, he swept Jessie briefly into his arms and danced her along the deck. Jessie got the barbecue going around 3:30, with the onset of the eclipse still an hour away, and went to ask her father if he wanted 2 burgers or just one. She found him on the south side of the house, below the deck on which she stood. He was wearing only a pair of cotton shorts, Yale Phys Ed was printed on one leg, and a quilted oven mitten. He had tied a bandana around his forehead to keep the sweat out of his eyes. He was crouched over a small, smoky sod fire. The combination of shorts and bandana gave him an odd but pleasant look of youth. Jessie could, for the first time in her life, see the man with whom her mother had fallen in love during her senior summer. Several squares of glass, panes cut carefully out of the crumbling putty in an old shed window, were piled up beside him. He was holding one in the smoke rising from the fire, using the barbecue tongs to turn the glass square this way and that like some sort of weird camp delicacy. Jessie burst out laughing. It was mostly the oven mitt that struck her as funny, and he turned around, also grinning. The thought that the angle made it possible for him to look up her dress crossed her mind, but only fleetingly. He was her father, after all, not some cute boy like Dwayne Corson from down at the marina. "What are you doing?" she giggled. "I thought we were having hamburgers for lunch, not glass sandwiches." "Eclipse viewers, not sandwiches, Punkin," he said. "If you put 2 or 3 of these together, you can look at the eclipse for the whole period of totality without damaging your eyes. You have to be really careful, I've read. You can burn your retinas and not even know you've done it until later."
"Blech,"
Jessie said, shivering a little. The idea of burning yourself without knowing you were doing it struck her as incredibly gross. "How long will it be total, Daddy?" "Not long. 1 minute or so." "Well, make some more of those glass whatchamacallums. I don't want to burn my eyes. 1 eclipse burger or 2? 1 will be fine, if it's a big one." "Okay." She turned to go. "Punkin?" She looked back at him, a small, compact man with fine beads of sweat standing out on his forehead. A man with as little body hair as the man she would later marry, but without either Gerald's thick glasses or his paunch. And for a moment, the fact that this man was her father seemed the least important thing about him. She was struck again by how handsome he was, and how young he looked. She looked back at his face and was suddenly, exquisitely aware of his eyes on her. Even narrowed against the smoke as they were now, those eyes were absolutely gorgeous, the brilliant gray of daybreak on winter water. Jessie found she had to swallow before she could answer. Her throat was dry. Possibly it was the acrid smoke from his sod fire. Or possibly it was not.
Yes, Daddy?
For a long moment he said nothing, only went on looking up at her with sweat running slowly down his cheeks and forehead and chest and belly, and Jessie was suddenly frightened. Then he smiled again, and all was well. You look very pretty today, Punkin. In fact, if it doesn't sound too yucky, you look beautiful.
Thank you. It doesn't sound yucky at all.
And it didn't. In fact, his comment pleased her so much, especially after her mother's angry editorial comments of the night before, or perhaps because of them, that a lump rose in her throat and she felt like crying for a moment. She smiled instead, and sketched a curtsy in his direction, and then hurried back to the barbecue with her heart pounding a steady drum roll in her chest. One of the things her mother had said, the most awful thing, tried to rise into her mind.
You behave as if she was your...
And Jessie squashed it ruthlessly, as she would have squashed a bad-tempered wasp. Still, she felt gripped by one of those crazy adult mixes of emotion, ice cream and gravy, roast chicken stuffed with sour balls, and could not seem to entirely escape it. Nor was she sure she even wanted to. In her mind, she kept seeing that single drop of sweat tracking lazily down his stomach, being absorbed by the soft cotton of his shorts, leaving that tiny, dark place. It was from that image that the emotional turmoil seemed chiefly to arise. She kept seeing it and seeing it and seeing it. It was crazy. Well, so what? It was a crazy day, that was all. Even the sun was going to do something crazy. Why not leave it at that? Yes, the voice that would one day masquerade as Ruth Neary agreed. Why not? The Eclipse burgers, garnished with sautéed mushrooms and mild red onion, were nothing short of fabulous. They certainly eclipsed the last batch your mother made, her father told her. And Jessie giggled wildly. They ate on the deck outside Tom Mayhoot's den, balancing metal trays on their laps. A round deck table, littered with condiments, paper plates, and eclipse-watching paraphernalia, stood between them. The observation gear included Polaroid sunglasses, two homemade cardboard reflector boxes of the sort which the rest of the family had taken with them to Mount Washington, panes of smoked glass, and a stack of hot pads from the drawer beside the kitchen stove. The panes of smoked glass weren't hot anymore, Tom told his daughter, but he wasn't terribly competent with a glass cutter, and he was afraid there still might be nicks and jagged spots along the edges of some of the panes. The last thing I need, he told her, is for your mother to come home and find a note saying I've taken you to the emergency room at Oxford Hills Hospital so they can try to sew a couple of your fingers back on. Mom really wasn't exactly crazy about this idea, was she? Jessie asked. Her daddy gave her a brief hug. No, he said. But I was. I was crazy enough about it for both of us. And he gave her a smile so bright, she just had to smile back. It was the reflector boxes they used first as the time of the eclipse, 4:29 p.m. EDT, neared. The sun lying in the center of Jessie's reflector box was no bigger than a bottle cap, but it was so fiercely bright that she groped a pair of the sunglasses from the table and put them on. According to her Timex, the eclipse should have already started. It said 4:30. I guess my watch is fast, she said nervously. Either that or there's a bunch of astronomers all over the world with egg on their faces. Check again, Tom said, smiling. When she looked back into the reflector box, she saw that the brilliant circle was no longer a perfect circle. A crescent of darkness now dented the right-hand side. A shiver slipped down her neck. Tom, who had been watching her instead of the image inside his own reflector box, saw it. Punkin? all right?
Yes, but it's a little scary, isn't it?
Yes, he said. Glanced at him and was deeply relieved to see he meant it. He looked almost as scared as she felt, and this only added to his winning boyishness. The idea that they might be afraid of different things had never entered her mind. Want to sit on my lap, Jess?
Can I?
You bet. She slipped onto his lap, still holding her own reflector box in her hands. She wiggled around to get comfortable against him, liking the smell of his faintly sweaty, sun-warmed skin, and a faint trace of some aftershave. Redwood, she thought it was called. The sundress rode up on her thighs. It could hardly do anything else, as short as it was, and she barely noticed when he put his hand on one of her legs. This was her father, after all. Daddy. Not Dwayne Corson from down at the marina, or Richie Ashlock, the boy she and her friends moaned and giggled over at school. The minutes passed slowly. Every now and then she squirmed around, trying to get comfortable. His lap seemed strangely full of angles this afternoon, and at one point she must have dozed off for 3 or 4 minutes. It might have been even longer, because the puff of breeze that came strolling down the deck and woke her up was surprisingly cold against her sweaty arms, and the afternoon had changed somehow. Colors which had seemed bright before she leaned back against his shoulder and closed her eyes were now pale pastels, and the light itself had weakened somehow. It was as if she thought the day had been strained through cheesecloth. She looked into her reflector box and was surprised, almost stunned, actually, to see that only half the sun was there now. She looked at her watch and saw it was 5:09.
It's happening, Daddy. The sun's going out.
Yes, he agreed. His voice was odd somehow, deliberate and thoughtful on top, somehow blurry down below. Right on schedule. She noticed in a vague sort of way that his hand had slipped higher, quite a bit higher, actually, on her leg while she had been dozing.
Can I look through the smoke glass yet, Dad?
Not yet, he said, and his hand slid higher still along her thigh. It was warm and sweaty, but not unpleasant. She put her own hand over it, turned to him, and grinned.
It's exciting, isn't it?
Yes, he said in that same odd, blurry tone. Yes, it is, Punkin. Quite a bit more than I thought it would be, actually. More time passed. In the reflector box, the moon continued to nibble away at the sun as 5:25 passed, and then 5:30. Almost all of her attention was now focused on the diminishing image in the reflector box, but some faint part of her became aware once again of how oddly hard his lap was this afternoon. Something was pressing against her bottom. It wasn't painful, but it was insistent. To Jessie, it felt like the handle of some tool, a screwdriver, or maybe her mother's tack hammer. Jessie wriggled again, wanting to find a more comfortable spot on his lap, and Tom drew in a quick, hissing mouthful of air over his bottom lip.
Daddy, am I too heavy? Did I hurt you?
No, you're fine. She glanced at her watch. 5:35 now. 4 minutes to totality. Maybe a little more if her watch was running fast.
Can I look at it through the glass yet?
Not yet, Punkin. But very soon. She could hear Debbie Reynolds singing something from the Dark Ages, courtesy of WNCH. The old hootie owl, hootie hoos to the dove, Tammy, Tammy, Tammy's in love. It finally drowned in a sticky swirl of violins and was replaced by the disc jockey, who told them it was getting dark in Ski Town, USA. This was the way the NCH DJs almost always referred to North Conway, but that the skies were too cloudy over on the New Hampshire side of the border to actually see the eclipse. The DJ told them there were a lot of disappointed folks wearing sunglasses across the street on the town common.
We're not disappointed folks, are we, Daddy?
Not a bit, he agreed, and shifted beneath her again.
We're about the most happy folks in the universe, I guess. Jessie peered into the reflector box again, forgetting everything except the tiny image which she could now look at without narrowing her eyes down to protective slits behind the heavily tinted Polaroid sunglasses. The dark crescent on the right, which had signaled the onset of the eclipse, had now become a blazing crescent of sunlight on the left. It was so bright it almost seemed to float over the surface of the reflector box. "Look out on the lake, Jessie." She did, and behind the sunglasses her eyes widened. In her rapt examination of the shrinking image in the reflector box, she had missed what was going on all around her. Pastels had now faded to ancient watercolors, a premature twilight, both entrancing and horrifying to the 10-year-old girl, was slipping across Darkscore Lake. Somewhere in the woods an old hooty owl cried out softly, and Jessie felt a sudden hard shudder bend its way through her body. On the radio, an AMCO transmission ad ended, and Marvin Gaye began to sing.
"Ow! Listen, everybody, especially you girls. Is it right to be left alone when the one you love is never home?"
The owl hooted again in the woods to the north of them. It was a scary sound, Jessie suddenly realized. A very scary sound. This time, when she shivered, Tom slipped an arm around her. Jessie leaned gratefully back against his chest.
"It's creepy, Dad."
"It won't last long, honey. And you'll probably never see another one. Try not to be too scared to enjoy it." She looked into her reflector box. There was nothing there. "I love too hard, my friends sometimes say."
"Dad? Daddy, it's gone. Can I..."
"Yes. Now it's okay. But when I say you have to stop, you have to stop. No arguments, understand?" She understood all right. She found the idea of retinal burns, burns you apparently didn't even know you were getting until it was too late to do anything about them, a lot scarier than the hooty owl off in the woods. But there was no way she wasn't going to at least have a peek, now that it was actually here, actually happening. No way. "But I believe," Marvin sang with the fervor of the converted. "Yes, I believe that a woman should be loved that way." Tom Mayhoot gave her one of the oven potholders, then three panes of smoked glass in a stack. He was breathing fast, and Jessie suddenly felt sorry for him. The eclipse had probably given him the creeps, too, but of course he was an adult and wasn't supposed to let on. In a lot of ways, adults were sad creatures. She thought about turning around to comfort him, then decided that would probably make him feel even worse, make him feel stupid. Jessie could sympathize. She hated to feel stupid worse than anything. Instead, she held the smoked panes of glass up in front of her, then slowly raised her head from her reflector box to look through them. "Now you chicks should all agree," Marvin sang. "This ain't the way it's supposed to be. So let me hear you, yeah. Let me hear you say yeah, yeah." What Jessie saw when she looked through the makeshift viewer. At this point, the Jessie handcuffed to the bed in the summer house on the shore of Kashwakamak Lake, the Jessie who was not 10 but 39 and a widow of almost 12 hours, suddenly realized two things: that she was asleep, and that she was not so much dreaming about the day of the eclipse as reliving it. She had gone on a while thinking it was a dream, only a dream, like her dream of Will's birthday party, where most of the guests had either been dead or people she wouldn't actually meet for years. This new mind movie had the surreal but sensible quality of the earlier one. But that was an untrustworthy yardstick, because that whole day had been surreal and dreamlike. First the eclipse, and then her father. "No more," Jessie decided. "No more, I'm getting out of this."
she made a convulsive effort to rise out of the dream or recollection or whatever it was. Her mental effort translated into a whole-body twitch, and the handcuff chains jingled mutedly as she twisted violently from side to side. She almost made it. For a moment, she was almost out. And she could have made it, would have made it, if she hadn't thought better of it at the last moment. What stopped her was an inarticulate but overwhelming terror of a shape, some waiting shape that might make what had happened that day on the deck seem insignificant by comparison. If she had to face it, that was. Maybe I don't have to. Not yet. And perhaps the urge to hide and sleep wasn't all. There might have been something else as well. Some part of her that intended to have this out in the open once and for all, no matter what the cost. She sank back down on the pillow, eyes closed, arms held up and sacrificially spread, her face pale and tight with strain. "Especially you girls," she whispered into the darkness. "Especially all you girls." She sank back on the pillow, and the day of the eclipse claimed her again.